Hello and welcome to the studio. Today we are with Dr. Pishvine, and we're going to talk a little bit about how biomarker-directed strategies are set to transform treatment in GI oncology. So to set the scene, how has the GI cancer paradigm shifted over the last 5 to 10 years from a more disease site-specific one-size-fits-all approach to a molecularly defined one?
I think it's been a really exciting time in GI malignancies and cancer broadly, but certainly in GI malignancies. And we really are seeing an era where we're directing therapies based on specific biomarkers. I would argue, actually, this started as far back as about 2008, 2009, with understanding the role of RAS mutations in anti-EGFR therapy in colorectal cancer and learning to divide colorectal cancer into different groups, RAS mutated versus RAS wild type. But it has definitely gotten much more advanced in the last 5 or 10 years, as you mentioned. And there are very specific biomarker subgroups of patients for whom specific therapies can work particularly well. Some of those biomarkers do cross disease types, and so there are now a couple of biomarker-specific indications for various genetic alterations, like, for example, MSI-high tumors writ large, NTRK fusion-positive tumors writ large. Those are therapies that are approved based on the biomarker, not based on the disease. But even within different disease subgroups, whether it's upper GI, biliary, pancreatic, colorectal, we are definitely seeing subgroups of patients being identified for whom these therapies can be really powerful.
Speaking actually of something that you said there, you mentioned a couple tumor types in which progress is being made. So which GI tumor types specifically have led the way here and which really still lag behind?
I think there has been waves of different diseases moving forward. Like for a while in the 2000 teens, it was pancreatic cancer that was really exciting with BRCA mutated tumors having a drug indication for maintenance therapy. Then the biliary data started to really come out very strongly. And as you mentioned, in the past few years, upper GI data has really come out very, very strongly. And there have been some really transformational studies in upper GI cancers as well. Colorectal cancer has lagged behind a little bit, again, only until just the last 2 or 3 years, where there is a real paradigm shift in how we manage first-line metastatic colorectal cancer patients now, and also even adjuvant therapy for colorectal cancer.
I want to shift a little bit now to talking about some of the latest developments to emerge from this year's ASCO GI meeting. So specifically, results from the HERIZON GEA-01 trial showed unprecedented survival outcomes with zanidatamab plus chemotherapy without tislelizumab. Why are these results so significant for the field?
I will say this is a little bit controversial, but I'm definitely on the side that said this is transformational data, that this should lead to an FDA approval, and that, quite frankly, this should be the new standard of care for how we treat our HER2-positive upper GI cancer patients. So that, as you mentioned, as you know, the addition of zanidatamab to chemotherapy and possibly with tislelizumab, the anti-PD-1 therapy, really led to survival rates and progression-free survival rates that we've never seen before. And the study was well-designed in that it did test it against a control arm of chemotherapy plus trastuzumab, which was definitely the previous standard of care for HER2-positive upper GI cancers. But what we're seeing in terms of progression-free survival in both the zanidatamab alone arm and the zanidatamab plus tisle arm are months longer than with chemotherapy plus trastuzumab. And at least for one of the arms, the zanidatamab alone arm, the overall survival is trending, but it was an early interim analysis and may also be positive. But these are survival increases, measured in months, not a couple of weeks or just 1 month, but, 5 or 6 months. And so I think it really should be the new standard of care.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting. Most of what I've heard about this trial is very positive. Most of my interviewees would agree with you that this is practice changing, but you mentioned this is a little controversial. Could you elaborate on some of the reasons why that is?
Well, so one of the controversies was the fact that there was not the overall survival data that had matured for the zanidatamab alone arm. And then the other controversial criticism that is legitimate, and I think it was not possible at the time that the study was designed, was that there was no arm of trastuzumab plus pembrolizumab. There's a previous study of trastuzumab, pembrolizumab, and chemotherapy for patients with HER2-positive upper GI cancers, which had outstanding results, response rates that were very, very high, and overall survival benefits that were unprecedented at the time. And that was not a control arm in this particular study. So, for example, we don't really technically know zani, tisle, chemo versus pembro, trastuzumab, chemo.
Okay, so definitely some areas that still need to be teased out. But on the whole, exciting stuff.
Yeah, very positive.
Thank you for elaborating on that. So how do you weigh the benefit of adding a PD-1 inhibitor compared with the increased toxicity burden?
Yeah. So what we're seeing across studies in upper GI cancers is that the immunotherapy drugs definitely do carry with them their own toxicities, but they're well known. They've been known for more than 10 years now. They do add to the profile, but I think we as oncologists have learned how to manage immunotherapy-related side effects. What is important from the HERIZON study was that zanidatamab seems to be a more toxic drug than trastuzumab, and the grade 3 adverse events rates were definitely higher with the addition of zanidatamab. And so I think that investigators, oncologists, are going to need to learn how to manage those side effects, which are primarily things like GI side effects, diarrhea in particular, for these patients who are getting to get this combination.
Where does Claudin 18.2 directed therapy stand today, and where is it headed based on what we're seeing?
Staying in the upper GI cancer realm, the addition of a Claudin 18.2 targeted therapy has also been transformational in treating metastatic upper GI cancers. And that's because about 25 to 30% of upper GI cancers are Claudin 18.2 high expressing. And the GLOW and SPOTLIGHT studies presented a few years ago showed us that adding zolbetuximab to standard of care chemotherapy clearly improved survival. At that time, in the unselected in terms of HER2, so HER2 negative population, et cetera, these were, of course, Claudin 18.2 high expressing patients. They reached at that time, previously unreached overall survival of about 18 months, which is pretty remarkable. There is the newer data that came out at ASCO GI 2026, the ILLUSTRA study, where they were testing the combination of chemotherapy, FOLFOX, with zolbetuximab, with nivolumab in upper GI cancers that were Claudin 18.2 expressing. In this case, they did have an intermediate and a high expressing subgroup. And long story short, the high expressing subgroup of patients did the best, but they did really, really amazingly well when they actually divided the patients into those who were high expressing Claudin 18.2 and CPS1 or greater. The progression-free survival rates were, if I recall, something on the order of 24, 25 months, which is just amazing that these patients are able to stay on the same therapy for 2 years before they have to switch to another therapy.
These specific data, teasing out these subgroups and on the whole realizing that people who express this biomarker do, you know, very well. Should Claudin 18.2 testing now be the standard of care at the time of initial diagnosis for all gastric and GEJ cancers? Why or why not? And what might some of the challenges with this be?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, 100%. This is something that should be tested. In fact, I've been very, very strongly making the argument that this is something that should be tested by the path lab before a patient even gets to see the oncologist. The patient should come with their report saying that they're HER2 positive or negative, that they're Claudin 18.2 high expressing or not, that we should know their CPS score when they're walking in the door. These are all really important factors in deciding how we start first-line therapy for patients with upper GI cancers.
Updated data from Cohort 3 of Breakwater shared at ASCO GI this year supported the FDA's decision to grant full approval to encorafenib plus cetuximab and chemotherapy in BRAF V600E mutant disease. Does this decision and the expansion of the approval to cover both mFOLFOX and FOLFIRI backbones change your frontline approach at all?
Absolutely. Just to give a little bit of color commentary and background, when the BEACON data came out for second-line therapy with encorafenib cetuximab, you know, it definitely was a beautifully done study, absolutely established a standard of care. But the benefit of encorafenib cetuximab in the second-line patients was, you know, was good, but it wasn't earth-shattering. And so I personally was a little skeptical about what the Breakwater data was going to look like. And I think I set myself up for just being blown away by the data that we've seen with Breakwater, both with FOLFOX and now more recently with FOLFIRI, adding encorafenib cetuximab for those BRAF V600E patients. And I think it's really established, it's sort of locked in a paradigm that we need to really look at for metastatic colorectal cancer now, where patients really need to be tested right from the get-go because there's at least 4 subgroups of patients that they really need to be pigeonholed into in terms of deciding how we treat with frontline therapy. So, of course, the first group are the MSI high patients or the MMR deficient patients, because with nivolumab and ipilimumab, we are seeing survival rates. Quite frankly, we can almost call them cure rates, where patients are living 5 years or more with that combination. So that's one subgroup that absolutely has to be carved out. Now, with the BRAF V600E data and Breakwater, absolutely those patients should be carved out because we need to give them encorafenib cetuximab from the beginning with either FOLFOX or FOLFIRI. And I think the data would suggest that either is perfectly reasonable. We also have the data with RAS wild-type tumors. So RAS-RAF wild-type tumors of the PARADIGM study. This is a few years ago of FOLFOX with panitumumab demonstrating a 39-month overall survival, which is remarkable at that time as well. And then there are still pending, but there are HER2-positive trials for colorectal cancer, which represents about 4 or 5% of colorectal cancer patients. And some of the later line studies look incredibly promising with their variety of HER2-targeted therapies. And those same agents are being tested in the frontline setting with FOLFOX and may also carve out another subgroup of patients. And then finally, actually, the catch-all everybody else subgroup are those who are, for example, RAS mutated, BRAF wild type, BRAF V600E non-mutated, but RAS mutated, that population should receive FOLFOXIRI and bevacizumab. So we have 4 or 5 subgroups of patients that are all biomarker-based decisions on how we treat the patient. So we need to get those results right away.
Moving on to somewhere maybe a little bit more challenging, KRAS has historically been a frustrating target, but the field is now moving beyond KRAS G12C inhibition. So what is the current state of KRAS inhibition in GI oncology, and where are we headed?
Well, we're having this conversation just a couple of days after the big announcement of daraxonrasib in the second-line setting demonstrating an overall survival benefit compared to standard of care chemotherapy. And I think many of us were hopeful that there was going to be a clear overall survival benefit. I don't think we expected this degree of overall survival benefit. The hazard ratio in that study was 0.4. The magnitude of benefit was 6-7 months in the second-line setting. I think it was a 13-month overall survival in the second-line setting. RAS-targeted therapy is going to be absolutely transformational for how we treat pancreatic cancer and perhaps other cancers as well. You did mention that it started with the KRAS G12C, which is sort of an easier molecule, an easier mutant to target. But, you know, a group of very smart scientists over the years have developed other ways of targeting the RAS gene, the RAS enzyme, with different therapies. And many of these studies are showing incredible promise. There's the pan-RAS inhibitor daraxonrasib, which, again, we hope is going to get FDA approval soon. But there are G12D-specific drugs. There are even other specific allele-specific drugs that are coming out. And across the board, many of these drugs are showing great promise.
Any others in particular that you have your eye on?
Yeah, the daraxonrasib was sort of first out of the gate of showing the most promise and the best data, and hopefully will be FDA approved here in just the next couple of months. But it does come with some significant side effects that we need to learn how to manage. The allele-specific inhibitors show similar promise. Of course, they're not compared head-to-head, but show similar promise, but with a lot less in the way of side effects. So zoldonrasib is a G12D inhibitor where data has been presented, showed about a 30% response rate. The Incyte drug that hasn't been named yet also shows about the same degree of promising benefit. There's also an Astellas G12D degrader, different mechanism of action, but also showed about a 20% response rate for patients with pancreatic cancer. And there are other avenues that are being explored as well.
Could combining KRAS and EGFR inhibition help combat disease resistance?
I think so. I think that one of my colleagues told me recently, like, the whole KRAS revolution isn't just about that we're going to be treating patients with KRAS inhibitors, but it's absolutely opening up a brand new door to a whole bunch of different combination potentials. One of the earliest combinations that was very logically explored was looking at KRAS G12C inhibition with an anti-EGFR therapy, and there was clearly an improvement in that example in colorectal cancer for the addition of a G12C inhibitor plus an anti-EGFR therapy. And so the similar cohorts are being explored in various other trials. But it also speaks to looking at mechanisms of resistance. As much as these RAS inhibitors have been transformational, they're unfortunately not curative, at least not in the metastatic setting. And the patient's tumor will eventually outsmart the RAS inhibitor. And so as we understand how some of those mechanisms are working to become resistant, we may be able to design rational combination therapies to either delay progression or delay resistance or actually improve response and perhaps actually improve long-term survival rates.
I'd like to now zoom out a little bit. We've talked about all of these really obviously interesting and promising therapeutic targets, but there's always some real-world considerations that need to be discussed. So updated clinical guidelines and emerging trial data support comprehensive biomarker testing at the time of initial diagnosis across multiple GI tumors. But in practice, how feasible is it to prioritize this level of testing? And how might you counsel community oncologists about navigating this increasingly complex biomarker landscape?
I am really excited to see that the guidelines have been advancing. In fact, in pancreatic cancer, we recently had the updated NCCN recommendations that basically all patients, not just those with advanced disease, which was the previous version, but now all patients, irrespective of stage with pancreatic cancer, should have biomarker testing to help guide the different therapies. And certainly in biliary cancer and colorectal cancer, the guidelines are all very much there out front saying we need to test, we need to test. The practical reality is that many patients are not being tested. The data has been really hard to come by, but those have actually looked at it. The testing rates across different GI cancers is anywhere from as low as 30% to at most maybe about 60% when you look at the entire sort of cancer community. And one might say that in the quote-unquote academic centers we're doing a better job. That's not even true. Even we in the academic centers are guilty for various reasons, some of them very legitimate, of not being able to biomarker test our patients. And so trying to tackle the strategies, even for those of us who are really, really acutely aware that we need to do this, trying to implement strategies to make sure that we're testing can make a really big difference. So some of the things that I've done in my own approach just in the last year, year and a half have been, for example, first of all, prioritizing testing from the get-go. So from the first time I meet the patient, we talk about biomarker testing and I initiate whatever biomarker testing I can. Second of all, particularly in the GI cancer world, pancreatic cancer, biliary cancer, oftentimes tissue is very scant, and so sending a tumor sample often comes back as non-diagnostic because there's just not enough there to be able to do the biomarker testing. So one thing I have employed is doing liquid NGS testing or blood-based NGS testing, which is not perfect, but what we do know is that if you do the blood-based NGS testing before you start any chemotherapy, the yield is much, much greater. So it's really important that you get that blood sample before you start any chemotherapy, and that increases your yield of getting the biomarker sample. The way I operate with patients, I literally walk into the room with them with two or sometimes three kits, a germline test, which we really didn't talk about, but we should be testing our patients, a liquid NGS testing kit, and in some cases, a circulating tumor DNA kits to track their progress over time.
That actually leads really nicely into one of my follow-up questions, thinking about ctDNA. Obviously, it's a big topic, but some people aren't sure that it's quite ready for prime time. So where does ctDNA testing currently fit into this landscape, and what information is still needed before ctDNA is really ready for routine integration, in your opinion?
I think ctDNA has definitely established itself pretty well in the postoperative setting, so patients who've had curative intent resection, and of course, primarily in colorectal cancer. And the data that we're seeing from colorectal cancer is very, very promising, where it's highly, highly prognostic, meaning that if you do a ctDNA test after surgery and it's negative, very good chance the patient's truly cured. If it's positive or eventually turns positive, very good chance that the cancer is eventually going to show itself again. We've also seen predictive advances in that group of patients where they're actually looking to see if in, for example, stage two patients, whether you can use ctDNA guided therapy to de-escalate therapy. That was the dynamic trial led by a woman named Jeannie Tai, and it was a remarkable study because it really allowed us to spare chemotherapy for a large proportion of patients who probably would not have benefited from it. And also perhaps actually increase the benefit for those who do need chemotherapy by giving them platinum-based or doublet therapy. So the dynamic study was really helpful for stage two patients. One thing that was disappointing, very well done study, but disappointing from the biology perspective, was that the subsequent dynamic study looked at stage three patients to ask the question whether we could use ctDNA-guided therapy to augment therapy for those at greater risk for recurrence. So they took patients with stage three disease for whom chemotherapy would be absolutely standard of care in the adjuvant setting, and they said for those who were ctDNA positive, can we do more than just the standard, for example, capecitabine oxaliplatin? And the long story short is that there was no benefit of augmenting therapy at all, really kind of demonstrating that biology rules the day and that these patients are going to have recurrence as dictated by their cancer, not necessarily by the additional chemotherapy.
I want to just back up a little bit. We were talking about all these different biomarkers, but when a patient is positive for more than one biomarker, how are clinicians currently prioritizing treatment decisions?
I was thinking about that question because it's actually come to me several times. And the reality is that in 10 years of looking biomarkers for patients with different cancers, primarily pancreatic cancer, but different cancers, while that question comes up a lot, that scenario does not come up very often at all. And so I don't mean to be ducking the question, but it just doesn't really happen all that often that you're faced with, for example, an MSI-high cancer that's also an NTRK fusion positive cancer. once in a while it does happen, and I think the answer to the question really is, where is the data the strongest? So, for example, for an MSI-high tumor, definitely the data for immunotherapy is very, very strong. For any fusion-positive tumor, whether it's NTRK, RET, NRG1, data is very strong for fusion-targeted therapies. One of the things that's going to come up, because RAS is such a common mutation in pancreatic cancer, is 95% of tumors are RAS mutated. We are going to start to face, for example, the RAS mutant patient, pancreatic cancer patient who also happens to have a BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation. That's a question we don't know the answer to yet. There actually are studies being designed to try and get at that answer. But really, the scenario is not as common as I would say. I think if I were ever faced with a scenario, I would look at the two studies, of course, being guilty of cross-trial comparison, and just basically go with wherever the data was stronger.
What upcoming clinical trial readouts or translational research efforts are most likely to reshape how clinicians test for and sequence targeted therapies in GI oncology over the next few years?
Well, we talked a little bit about implementing strategies to make sure the patients get tested, and we've certainly seen the importance of that in colorectal cancer, as I talked about earlier, where we have these four or five different subgroups, so you need to know right away. We're going to see similar studies for RAS inhibitors in both pancreatic cancer and other cancers. There are frontline strategies being tested for different first-line RAS-directed therapies. And if, in particular, the G12D or the allele-specific trials end up being positive, we're going to need to know who are the G12D-positive patients even before we start any treatment. So I think that the chemo plus G12D inhibitor trials in pancreatic cancer, there's three of them, three phase three trials that are being launched that are going to be really important. Interestingly, the one counterpoint to that argument is going to be in daraxonrasib specifically with the pan-RAS inhibitor daraxonrasib, and the frontline trial that they've just launched actually is non-biomarker-based. And the reason for that is that 95% of all pancreatic cancers are RAS mutated, so they figure they're going to cover most of the patients. And there are arguments that even the 5% who are non-RAS mutated, their tumors are still RAS-driven. And they are going to tease that out in the study, but that study is being designed in a non-biomarker-selected way. So that'll be interesting to see how that pans out.
Based on the data that we've discussed, what is one thing that you are doing differently in your own clinic today?
Well, I think, again, for me, the biggest thing that I'm doing differently is making sure that I don't miss a patient's testing and that I initiate the testing from the very first minute that I meet them so that I can get those results and implement a strategy either in the first line setting or being ready for subsequent lines of therapy from the get-go. I just can't emphasize enough, and I think I'm constantly on my soapbox about this, that it's so critical that we do biomarker testing. We are literally leaving a group of patients behind, and again, the data would suggest we're talking maybe up to 50% of patients. We're not giving them the optimal care that we can if we're not even looking for the biomarkers that may be present. And one thing that I often teach the fellows is there's nothing clinically about these patients that tell us that they have an MSI-high tumor or an NTRK fusion-positive tumor. It's only by testing that we'll ever figure out who those patients are and can get them the right therapy that really clearly is making a survival difference in their lives.
Well said, and I think a great note to end this on. So thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Absolutely.